So, on this particular planet, we have arrived at a stage near perfection, both materially and spiritually. But we have our roles to perform, as does every creature existing in the universe. In fact, everything, including a single pebble, has its role. Our role, as beings of a superior planet, is to guide, to help with spiritual development and even, sometimes, materially. We are in a position to give material assistance because we are technologically the most advanced people. Indeed, how could a father give spiritual guidance to his child if he were not older, more educated and more skilled in diplomacy than the child? If the child should require physical punishment, as unfortunately, is sometimes the case, isn't it important that the parent be physically stronger than the child? Certain adults, who refuse to listen and who are absolutely stubborn, also need to be corrected by physical means. You, Michelle, come from the planet Earth, which is sometimes called the planet of sorrows. Indeed, the name is appropriate, but it is this way for a precise reason. It is intended to provide a learning environment of a quite specific kind. It is not because life there is so difficult that you have to intervene. You cannot lightly go against nature, destroying rather than conserving what the Creator has put at your disposal, that is, interfering with ecological systems, which have been intricately designed. Certain countries, like Australia, where you are from, are beginning to show great respect for ecology, and it is a step in the right direction. But even in that country, what case is made of pollution, both water and air pollution? What is ever done about one of the worst forms of pollution? Noise. I say worst because people such as Australians pay virtually no attention to it at all. Ask someone if traffic noise bothers him and the response will surprise you. 85% of the time it will be, "What noise? What are you talking about?" Oh, that noise, we get used to it. And it is precisely because they get used to it that the danger exists. Just then, Thora, as this high figure was called, made a gesture and I turned around. He was replying to a question I had mentally posed: how can he speak of percentages and know so much about our planet with so much precision? Turning around, I almost uttered a cry of surprise for, behind me, stood Biastra and Latley. In itself, this was nothing surprising, but the friends I knew who measured 310 and 280 centimeters in height respectively, were now reduced in size to correspond with my height. My mouth must have continued to gape, for Thora smiled. Can you understand, that sometimes, and very often in these days, some of us live among your people on Earth, and there is my answer to your question. To continue on the very important subject of noise, it is such a danger that, if nothing is done, catastrophe is certain. Let us take the example of a discotheque. The people who expose themselves to music that is typically played three times too loudly, are subjecting their brains and their physiological and astral bodies to vibrations which are so harmful. If they could see the damage that is caused, they would vacate the discotheque quicker than if there was a fire. But vibrations don't only come from noise, they also come from colors, and it is astonishing that, on your planet, experiments conducted in this field have not been followed up. Our agents reported a particular experiment involving a man who was capable of lifting a certain weight. It was found that editor's edition, after staring for a moment at a pink-colored screen, he consistently lost 30% of his strength. Your civilization pays no attention to such experimentation. In fact, colors can enormously influence the behavior of human beings, and yet, control of this influence requires that an individual's aura be taken into account. If, for example, you want to paint or wallpaper your bedroom with the colors that are truly appropriate for you, you must be aware of the colors of certain principal points of your aura. By matching the colors of your walls with those of your aura, you can improve your health or maintain good health. Further, the vibrations emanating from these colors are essential for good mental balance, exerting their influence even while you sleep. I was wondering how we could be expected to know these significant colors in our auras when, on Earth, we were not capable of perceiving auras. Of course, Aura replied immediately, without me having to say a word aloud. Michelle, it is now very important that your experts invent the special equipment necessary to enable perception of the aura, as this, in turn, will ensure that correct choices are made at the critical crossroads ahead. The Russians have already photographed the aura. This is the beginning, but the results obtained allow them only to read the first two letters of the alphabet, as it were, in comparison with what we are able to decipher. The reading of the aura in order to heal the physical body is nothing compared with what such a reading can achieve for the psychic body, or the physiological body. It is in the area of the psyche that, on Earth, your greatest problems exist. At the moment, most responsibility is taken for the physical body, but this is a serious mistake. If your psyche is poor, it will influence your physical appearance accordingly. But, regardless, your physical body will wear out and die one day, whereas your psyche, being part of your astral body, never dies. On the contrary, the more you cultivate your mind, the less you will be burdened by your physical body and the quicker you will proceed through your cycle of lives. We could have brought you to our planet in astral body, but instead, we have brought you here in physical body, and for an important reason. I see you already understand our reason. This pleases us and we thank you for your willingness to assist us in our task. The Thawra stopped talking and seemed to lapse into thought, at the same time, fixing me with his luminous eyes. I cannot say how much time elapsed. I know my state became more and more euphoric and I was aware that the auras of the seven personages were gradually changing. The colors became more vivid in places, softer in others, while the outer edges became misty. This mist became more golden and pink as it spread, gradually blurring the seven figures. I felt Thau's hand on my shoulder. No, you are not dreaming, Michelle. It's all quite real. She spoke very loudly and, as if to prove her point, she pinched my shoulder so hard, she left her bruise that could be seen for several weeks. Why did you do that? I would not have thought you capable of such violence, Thau. I'm sorry, Michelle, but sometimes strange means are employed. The Thauri always disappear, and sometimes appear in this manner, and you might have thought it part of a dream. I am entrusted with the task of ensuring that you recognize what is real. With these words, Thau pivoted me around and I followed her, as we departed by the same route we had come. Chapter 7. The Continent of Mu and Easter Island. Before leaving the Doko, Thau fitted a mask on my head, a mask that was different from the one I'd worn previously. I was able to see colors that were much more vivid and much more luminous. How do you feel in your new Voki, Michelle? Do you find the light tolerable?
Yes.
It's fine, it's so beautiful and I feel so. With that, I collapsed at Thau's feet. She took me in her arms and carried me to the flying platform. I awoke in my Doko, quite astonished. My shoulder was hurting. Quite instinctively I put my hand to the pain, and grimaced. I am really sorry, Michelle, but it was necessary. There was just a hint of remorse in Thau's expression. What happened to me? Let's say that you fainted, although the word is not quite appropriate. Rather, you were overwhelmed with beauty. Your new Voki allows 50% of the vibrations of color on our planet to pass, whereas your former Voki subdued all but 20%. Only 20%, that's incredible. All those marvelous colors I could see, the butterflies, the flowers, the trees, the ocean. No wonder I was overcome. I remember, during a journey I made from France to New Caledonia, we called in at the island of Tahiti. While there, I toured the island with family and friends, in a hired car. The islanders were delightful and made such a charming picture, with their straw hats constructed on the banks of lagoons amidst bougainvillea, hibiscus and exeras, red, yellow, orange and purple, surrounded by well-kept lawns and shaded by coconut trees. The backdrop to these scenes was provided by the blue of the ocean. We spent all day touring the island and I described it in my journal as having been an entire day of inebriation for my eyes. I was, indeed, intoxicated by the beauty around me, and yet, now, I admit all that was nothing compared with the beauty here on your planet. Thou had listened to my description with marked interest, smiling all the while. She placed her hand on my forehead and said, "Rest now, Michelle. Later you will feel better and will be able to come with me." I fell asleep immediately and slept peacefully, without dreaming, I think for about 24 hours. When I awoke, I felt rested and refreshed. Thou was there, and Latli and Biastra had joined her. They had regained their normal size and I commented on the fact straight away. "Little time is required for such a metamorphose, Michelle," explained Biastra, "but that is not important. Today we are going to show you something of our country and introduce you to some very interesting people." Latli approached me and touched my shoulder with her fingertips, just where Thou had bruised me. Instantly, the pain vanished and I felt quivers of well-being run through my whole body. She returned my smile and handed me my new mask. I still found that, outside, I had to squint against the light. Thou gestured to me indicating that I should climb onto the Latavok as our flying platform was called. The others chose to fly independently, fluttering about our vehicle, as though playing a game, and no doubt they were. On this planet, the inhabitants seemed perpetually happy, the only ones I had found to be serious, in fact, even a little severe, despite their air of benevolence, were the seven Thori. Thori is the plural of Thora. We flew at high speed, several meters above the water and, although my curiosity was constantly aroused, I often had to close my eyes to allow them to recover from the brightness. Still, it appeared I was going to become accustomed to it. I wondered how I would cope though, if it occurred to Thou to give me a mask which permitted 70% of the light to penetrate, or even more. We rapidly approached the coast of the mainland, where waves were breaking over rocks of green, black, orange and gold. The iridescence of the water, crashing against the rocks, under the perpendicular rays of a midday sun, created a memorably lovely effect. A band of light and color was formed, 100 times more crystalline than a rainbow on Earth. We rose to an altitude of about 200 meters and proceeded to travel over the continent. Thou flew us over a plain on which I could see animals of all sorts. Some were two-legged and resembled little ostriches, others were four-legged creatures, similar to mammoths, but twice as big. I also watched cows graze side by side with hippopotamuses. The cows were so similar to those we have on Earth, I couldn't help but remark on it to Thou, pointing as I did so, at a particular herd, just like an excited child at a zoo. She laughed heartily. "Why shouldn't we have cows here, Michelle? Look over there and you'll see donkeys and there, giraffes, although they are somewhat taller than on Earth. See how lovely those horses are as they run together." I was thrilled, but wasn't I constantly thrilled by this experience? Sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. What really rendered me speechless, to the amusement of my friends, was the sight of horses bearing the heads of very pretty women, some blonde, others auburn or brown and even some with blue hair. As they galloped, they would often soar for tens of meters. Ah yes. In fact, they had wings, folded back against their bodies, which they made use of from time to time, something like the flying fish which follow or precede ships. They lifted their heads to see us and tried to rival the speed of the Latavok. Thou reduced speed and altitude, enabling us to approach within several meters of them. There were more surprises ahead of me, as some of these horsewomen cried out to us in a language that was recognizably human. My three companions answered in the same language, and the exchange was obviously a pleasant one. We didn't linger long at that low altitude, however, as some of the horsewomen soared to such heights, they almost touched our vehicle, thereby risking injury to themselves. The plain we flew over was, in places, embossed with small knolls, all of about the same size. I remarked on them and Biastra explained that, millions of years ago, these knolls had been volcanoes. The vegetation below us had none of the exuberance of the forest I had experienced on my arrival. On the contrary, Here the trees were grouped in small stands, reaching no more than 25 meters in height. As we passed, large white birds took flight by the hundreds, only to land again, a safe distance away. A wide water course flowed to the horizon, dissecting the plain with its lazy wanderings. I could make out some small gokos grouped together on a bend of the river. Thau guided the Leitavok above the river, reducing altitude to water level as we approached the settlement. We landed in a small square between two dokos and were immediately surrounded by the inhabitants. They didn't scramble or push to get near us, rather, they stopped what they were doing and calmly approached us. They formed a circle large enough to be comfortable and for all to have equal opportunity to see an alien face to face. Again, it struck me that these people all seemed to be of the same age, apart from about half a dozen who could have been no older. Age, here, did not detract but added a quality of surprising nobility. I had also been struck by the absence of children on the planet, and yet, in this settlement and among the crowd that approached, I saw six or seven of them. They were charming and appeared to be quite level-headed for children. According to Thau, they would have been 8 or 9 years old. Since my arrival on Thauba, I had not yet had occasion to meet so great a number of these people. Glancing around the circle, I could appreciate a calmness and reserve about them, as well as the great beauty in their faces that I'd grown to expect. There was a strong resemblance between them, as if they were all brothers and sisters, and yet, isn't that our first impression when we encounter a group of blacks or Asians together? In fact, the same physical variety in facial features existed among these people, as exists within races on Earth. In height, they varied from 280 to 300 centimeters. Their bodies being so well proportioned, they were a pleasure to behold, neither too muscular nor too puny, and without deformity of any kind. Their hips were somewhat larger than you would expect in a man, but then I'd been told that some of them gave birth to children. All possessed magnificent heads of hair, most of a golden blonde color, others platinum blonde or coppery blonde and occasionally, a bright chestnut color. There were also some, like Thau and Biastra, with a fine down of hair on the upper lip. But, apart from this, these people had absolutely no other body hair. This is not, of course, an observation that I made at the time but one which I made later, when I had occasion to see from quite near, a group of naked sunbathers. Their skin type reminded me of Arab women who protect themselves from the sun. It was certainly not the pale skin typical of blondes with such light eyes. So light, indeed, were the mauve and blue eyes around me, that I might have wondered if they were blind, had I been on Earth. When I speak now, of their long legs and rounded thighs, they reminded me of our female long-distance runners, as well as their beautifully proportioned breasts, firm and shapely in every case. The reader will understand my error in believing Thau to be a female giant when first we met. It occurred to me that women on Earth would be most envious of the breasts of these people, and men would be most delighted by them. I have already commented on the beauty of Thau's face, and others in this crowd had similar classic features, still others I would describe as charming or alluring. Each face, though slightly different in shape and features, seemed to have been designed by an artist. Each had been given its own unique charm. But, above all, the quality most evident in their faces and in their manner and deportment, was the quality of intelligence. In all, I could find no fault with these people who grouped around us, beaming smiles of welcome which revealed rows of perfect white teeth. This physical perfection did not surprise me, since Thau had explained their ability to regenerate their body cells at will. There was no reason, therefore, that these magnificent bodies should age. Are we interrupting them in their work? I asked Biastra, who happened to be by my side. No, not really, she replied. Most of the people in this town are on vacation. It is also a place where people come to meditate. Three of the elders approached and Thau asked that I address them in French, and loudly enough for everyone to hear. I believe I said, I am very happy to be among you and to be able to admire your wonderful planet. You are fortunate people and I, myself, would like to live among you." This speech released a concert of exclamation, not only on account of the language, which most of them had never before heard spoken, but also for the sense of what I had said, which had been telepathically communicated. By Astra signaled we should follow the three elders, who led us into one of the dokos. When the seven of us were comfortably installed, Thao began, "Michelle, I would like to introduce you to Lashusi." She held her hand towards one of the three and I bowed. Lashusi was, about 14,000 of your years ago, the last king of the continent Mu on Earth. "I don't understand." "You don't want to understand, Michelle, and, at this particular moment, you resemble many of your peers on Earth." I must have looked troubled, for Thao, by Astra and Latli laughed loudly. "Don't look like that, Michelle. I just meant to jostle you a little. Now, in the presence of Lashusi, I am going to explain one of the mysteries that elude many experts on your planet, who, I might add, would do better to devote their precious time discovering more useful things. I am going to unveil not one, but several of the mysteries which obsess them." Our seats were arranged in a circle. Thao sat next to Lashusi and I sat facing them. As I already explained during our journey to Thiuba, the Bakaratinians arrived on Earth 1,350,000 years ago. 30,000 years later came the terrible cataclysm that gouged out seas and caused the emergence of islands and even continents. I made mention also, of an enormous continent which arose in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. This continent was called Lamar but is better known to you as the continent of Mu. It emerged virtually in one piece, to be shattered 2,000 years later, by seismic shock, into three principal continents. With the passing of years, vegetation established on these continents, large areas of which were located in equatorial regions. Grass grew, forests established and, gradually, animals migrated across the very narrow isthmus that bound Mu to North America. The yellow race, who had better managed to come to terms with the disastrous consequences of the cataclysm, were first to construct ships and explore the seas. About 300,000 Earth years ago, they landed on the northwest coast of Mu, where they eventually founded a small colony. This colony barely grew over the course of centuries as there were difficulties in expatriating, which would take too long to explain and which does not concern us now. About 250,000 Earth years ago, the inhabitants of planet Homo X3, on which we stopped to take samples during our journey here, embarked on an interplanetary voyage of exploration penetrating your solar system. After having skirted Saturn, Jupiter, Mars and Mercury, they landed on the planet Earth in China, where their spacecraft caused considerable panic among the populace. Their legends refer to fire dragons descending from the sky. The fear and mistrust of the Chinese led them eventually to attack the aliens, who were forced to use violence in order to defend themselves. This they hated, for they were not only technologically advanced but also highly spiritual people who abhorred killing. They moved on, continuing their exploration of the planet. It turned out that the continent of Mu had most appeal for them for two main reasons. First, the continent appeared to be virtually uninhabited and second, by virtue of its latitude, it was a veritable paradise. They had become particularly cautious since their confrontation with the Chinese and felt it would be wise to establish a base to which they could retreat, should they encounter further hostilities of a serious nature from Earth people. I have not yet explained that their reason for exploring Earth was their intention of resettling several million people from Homo X3, a planet that was becoming uncomfortably overpopulated. This operation was much too serious to take risks of any kind. Thus, it was decided that their base of retreat would be set up, not on Earth, but on the Moon, which was quite close and considered very safe. 50 years were spent establishing the lunar bases and it wasn't until they were ready that emigration to Mu began. All went well. The small Chinese colony that had existed in the northwest of Mu had been totally destroyed some decades after their first visit, so in effect, they had the entire continent to themselves. Work began immediately on the construction of towns, canals and roads, which they paved with immense flagstones. Their usual means of transport was a flying chariot, not unlike our later Vox. From their planet, they imported animals such as the dog and the armadillo, which they were very partial to on Amo X3, and also the pig. When she told me about all those imported animals, I remembered how astonished I'd been to see pigs and dogs on that famous planet during our earlier visit. Suddenly, everything was very clear to me. In height, these people averaged 180 centimeters for the males, and 160 centimeters for the females. Their hair was dark, their eyes of a beautiful black and their skin lightly bronzed. You saw some of their kind when we stopped at Amo X3 and I believe you have already guessed them to be the ancestors of the Polynesians. So they established settlements throughout the length and breadth of the continent, including 19 large cities, 7 of which were sacred. Small villages were also numerous, for these people were highly skilled farmers and graziers. Their political system was modeled on that of Amo X3. They had long ago discovered that the only way to govern a country properly was to place at the head of government, 7 men of integrity, representing no political party, but sincerely committed to doing what they could for their nation. The 7th among them was the supreme judge whose vote on council was worth 2. If 4 were against him and 2 with him on a particular issue, they were at deadlock, and hours or days of debate would ensue, until at least one of the 7 was persuaded to change his vote. This debate was conducted within a context of intelligence, love and concern for the people. These high figures received no great material benefits for leading the nation. It was their vocation to lead and they did it for the love of serving their country. This avoided the problem of hiding opportunists among the leaders. The same can't be said of our national leaders now, I remarked with a hint of bitterness. Where were such men found? The procedure was as follows. In a village or district, a man of integrity was elected by referendum. No one with a record of bad conduct or a tendency towards fanaticism could be chosen. The chosen one would have demonstrated integrity in all spheres. He would then be sent to the nearest town, along with other representatives from neighboring villages, and there, further elections would be held. For example, if there were 60 villages, there would be 60 men elected by the people for their integrity and not for promises which they made, but couldn't keep. Representatives from all over the nation would meet together in the capital city. They would be divided into groups of 6 and each group assigned a particular conference room. For the next 10 days the group would be together, holding discussions, sharing meals, enjoying shows and, eventually, they would elect a group leader. So, if there had been 60 representatives, divided into 10 groups, there would be 10 group leaders. Of these 10, 7 would be elected by the same process, and from the 7, an eventual supreme leader would emerge. He was given the title of king. So, he was a republican king, I said. Thou smiled at my remark and Lashnusi gave a slight frown. The king was elected in this way only if his predecessor died without having nominated a successor, or if the successor was not unanimously accepted by the Council of 7. He was given the title of king, first because he was the representative on earth of the Great Spirit, and second because 9 times out of 10, he would be the son or near relative of the preceding king. Something like the Roman method, then. Yes indeed. However, if this king manifested the slightest tendency towards dictatorship, he was overthrown by his council of peers. But let's go back now to our emigrants from Amo X3. Their capital city, given the name Savanasa, was situated on a plateau overlooking the Gulf of Suvatu. The plateau was 300 meters high and, except for 2 hills, one in the southwest and one in the southeast, this was the highest point on the continent of Mu. I'm sorry, Thou, may I interrupt? When you explained the cataclysm which knocked the Earth off its axis, you said that refuge on the moon was not possible because it didn't exist, and yet now, you say that safety bases were established on the moon for these emigrants.